The art of losing isn't hard to master. You may, in fact, already be losing up to 9 things per day if you're similar to respondents in a 2012 survey conducted by a British insurance company. Cell phones, keys, and paperwork top the list. We're not in the habit of thinking positively about our losses, maybe other than the enjoyment of losing ourselves in a good book or some other favorite activity. Aside from the few things we wish we could lose, like weight, a bad cough, the attentions of a bully, loss feels like a hole, an emptiness. Loss is an undesirable subtraction of something from our lives, or an absence of something we were never able to attain. Poet Naomi Shihab Nye writes, "Once a class of unruly students came into sudden clear focus when I entered their room and said simply, 'What have you lost? Write it down.' The lists were long and haunted. Freedom, memory, cats, great aunts, being little. I remember more people turning over their papers to write on the backs that day than ever before. Everyone had lost so much already. Their poems were thoughtful, poignant ruminations, by far the best descriptive and narrative writing in our time together. I was reminded of something a teacher told us once when I was in school. The things that cause you friction are the things from which you might make art. Surely losing is one of the most endemic frictions of our journey. Loss is inevitable, an everyday thing. Big losses, small losses. Some we move through and pass quickly, others not so quickly. The longer you live, the more you lose. Objects, relationships, direction, abilities, hopes, dreams." Naomi Shihab Nye continues, "Is there anything good about losing? Does loss help us discover anything? Maybe sometimes we notice or take better care of what we still have momentarily. No matter how many things we've already lost, we don't necessarily find losing any easier to heal from or comprehend. The way we view our losses seems to have a lot to do not only with their scale and their degree of permanence, but with our assessment of how much control we did or didn't have over losing whatever we lost. And being culturally conditioned to a competitive mindset as we are might lead us to believe we have more control over the circumstances of our losses than we actually do. When we divide the world into winners and losers, we constantly rank ourselves against each other, as well as against what we believe is possible. Everybody knows nobody can win all the time. You win some, you lose some. But we behave as if everything we want is ultimately winnable. It's all about strategy. You have to figure out or understand the rules and then work them to your own gain, maybe bending them a little here and there. How far are you willing to go to get something you really want, to win? Hand in hand with a competitive mindset is a scarcity mindset. There's only one gold medal in every event. After all, resources are scarce. Praise and recognition are scarce. Even time is scarce. Get your share, or better yet, win over others and ensure a bigger share. It seems that we actually get a better ego buzz that way. A Carnegie Mellon and Harvard study found that our happiness increases when we get a raise and someone else doesn't, but not when everyone's income is increased. We like to think that our wins are always the result of individual effort. Yet we know that most societies, including ours, at one time or another, have rigged the game so that certain people are born losers. By being female, by being the wrong color, being the wrong sexual orientation, or inheriting the wrong religion. People automatically lose if they turn out the wrong weight or the wrong height or speak with the wrong accent. Anyone who benefits from the rigged game comes to feel entitled to their safety and security, their winner-take-all rewards. If losers start to raise questions about rules, winners cling harder to their advantages, sometimes moving the finish line, sometimes resorting to dishonesty, aggression, or violence. We see this play out not just in attempts to literally destroy imagined opponents, as in mass shootings or police brutality, but in day-to-day petty competitions in workplaces, on the freeways, in parking lots and grocery lines where people cut each other off and jockey for position as if everything is a race and their lives depend on winning. We do not want to come in last at anything. Sometimes we get mindlessly caught up in these meaningless contests, even when they go contrary to what we think of as our deeply held values. I know I do. Consider the possibility that our obsession with winning causes us to generalize so far that we equate almost every kind of loss with failure, even ones that are the result of natural cycles and processes. Take getting older. Once people are past a certain age, bodily changes are described almost exclusively in terms of loss. You lose your hair, your skin tone, your eyesight, your hearing, your coordination, your memory, the list goes on. What does it add up to? Nothing but a failure to be young, or to at least appear young. Rarely does anyone talk about human development in terms of loss when it comes to children. But if you think about language development, when infants start to babble, they make every sound humanly possible. But in the course of focusing exclusively on the language of their parents or primary caregivers, long before they reach adulthood, children eventually lose the ability to trill their tongues and make clicks and all those other things that you find in languages around the world that we can't do. No one really considers this a failure of any kind, though. It's just the way we think. What if we thought differently and refused to let loss define us? This is not to deny decay and death, because we're already doing that anyway. For those who can afford it, there are plenty of ways to maintain the illusion of youth more or less indefinitely. And I can't recall who said this, but it stuck with me ever since I heard it. Americans think death is optional. And certainly we are willing to go to great medical lengths to try and at least cheat death, even if it's the one thing we really can't win over. What's it all about? First, we just don't like how it feels to lose. So we do all kinds of seemingly irrational and illogical things to avoid it. This phenomenon is known as loss aversion in economics and decision theory. So most studies pertaining to loss aversion suggest that losses are twice as powerful psychologically as gains. This information is typically applied in marketing, but it might possibly serve us in understanding our motivations in other areas also. And then there's the fact that we don't get good training in how to handle our losses. The only thing worse than a loser, of course, is a sore loser, a whiner. We learn early to hush up when we fail because nobody likes a poor sport or a crybaby. We learn early to stifle our feelings, even though they might be an entirely appropriate response to the situation. Sadness is a normal reaction to any kind of loss, but we are encouraged to get past sadness as soon as possible, even when you've suffered some major life catastrophe. Other people only have so much tolerance for your grief before they start to send message indicating that you should get over it and move on. We are as profoundly uncomfortable with other people's losses as we are with our own. And while it's true that some people get stuck in a victim mentality about their losses and try ineffectively to use them as a way to connect with or emotionally manipulate others, most of us eventually turn our feelings inward and limp along, doing the best we can by ourselves. Due to lack of instruction and practice, we are not skilled at sitting with our sadness long enough to learn what it has to teach us. We worry that it's taking too long, so we rush to resolve it, or at least give the appearance of having resolved it. This rush to resolve our discomfort can lead us straight to blame. We blame others for getting in our way, or we blame ourselves for not controlling the situation the way we think we should have. If only someone or something had been different, we could have won. We could have prevented ourselves from losing. Alan Langer, psychologist and author of several books about mindfulness, tells this story in an episode of Public Radio's On Being program. She says, many years ago, I had a major fire that destroyed 80% of what I owned. And when I called the insurance company and they came over the next day, the insurance agent said to me that this was the first call he'd ever had where the damage was worse than the call. I thought, well, gee, you know, it's already taken my stuff. Why give it my soul? Why pay twice? Which is what people so often do. Something happens, you have that loss, and then you're going to now throw all your emotional energy at it. And so you're doubling up on the negativity. So if we go back to the study about losing track of cell phones and keys and paperwork, on the surface that seems like a pretty small problem because we usually locate those things again unless, you know, you put your cell phone on your car and drive away or something like that. And don't realize it for 10 miles. But haven't you ever worked yourself into a frenzy while searching for those things or beaten yourself up for your failing memory or for wasting time by not being more organized? Our self-recrimination in the face of bigger losses is proportional. If only I had taken a different route. If only I hadn't said that. If only I'd been a better parent or a better friend. If only. And if we allow ourselves to start comparing our suffering with the suffering of others, it can become another contest in and of itself, laden with self-judgment. We don't just pay twice for our losses, we pay over and over. We go round and round in our heads with these stories, promising ourselves we'll try harder, plotting ways to prove we're not as bad of a loser as we might look or feel, all in an attempt to keep at arm's length the other feeling associated with loss and failure. The one that feels even worse than sorrow or grief, shame. Over the past decade or so, social scientist Brené Brown has done extensive research on shame and vulnerability. In a culture that celebrates winning as a show of worthiness and strength, vulnerability is seen as a weakness, the character trait of a loser. Brené Brown's findings indicate otherwise. She says, I define vulnerability as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Vulnerability is not weakness because the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure we face every day are not optional. Our only choice is a question of engagement. Engagement takes courage. The courage to question your internal narrative, to quote from Brené Brown again, to peel away layer after layer of beliefs, behaviors, and assumptions, and rigorously hold yourself accountable to life. Engagement is definitely not for weaklings. When we engage with life, we stumble and fall and pick ourselves up again, time after time, and we do it not because it will eventually lead to any kind of victory, but because it will enable us to live wholehearted lives full of meaningful connections with the people around us. To not engage with life and move through our failures to greater self-understanding is the real loss. Parker Palmer, a Quaker teacher and author, agrees. He writes, facing into failure can help vaporize the illusions that keep me from seeing reality. When I succeed at something, I don't spend much time wondering what I might learn from it. Instead, I congratulate myself on how clever I am, thus inflating my ego's favorite illusion. Failure gives me a chance to touch hard truths about myself and my relation to the world that I evade when I'm basking in the glow of success and the illusion it breeds. Brené Brown continues, the level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable is a measure of our fear and disconnection. When we feel good about the choices we're making and when we're engaging with the world from a place of worthiness rather than scarcity, we feel no need to judge and attack. In other words, we feel no need to compete with other people for our sense of self-worth. We feel no need to win. Or as Alfie Cohn, who was quoted in the second reading today, says, the real alternative to being number one is not being number two, but being psychologically free enough to dispense with rankings altogether. This idea tends to make us uncomfortable. If we don't strive to win at something, How will we ever achieve anything? How will we ever get anywhere in life? Won't we become passive and self-effacing? Doesn't it mean we won't ever work to challenge injustices or make positive changes in the world? In his writings, Alfie Kohn cites study after study showing that children's achievement levels are actually superior when they cooperate versus compete, and other studies which show that scientists, business people, academics, pilots, and experts in other professions report that personal challenge meant more to them than achievement through competition. The research of Kohn and Brown and others contradicts conventional thinking about how we motivate ourselves to do our best and what, in the long run, will actually make us happy. Viewing life in terms of winning and losing sets up a dualism. Practicing the art of losing requires us to embrace a paradox. The saying, you have to lose yourself in order to find yourself, sounds like a cliché, but it's been around for centuries as a serious spiritual concept. Even if you restate it as you need to let yourself lose in order to win, the general meaning doesn't alter much. Either way, like so many spiritual concepts, we don't find it easy to comprehend with our intellects, probably because it's not meant to be understood that way. The Sufi mystic Rumi writes, when you lose all sense of self, the bonds of 1,000 chains will vanish. Lose yourself completely. Return to the root of your own soul. When we resist the ego-gratifying seduction of identifying as a winner, we free ourselves. We open ourselves to richer, deeper lives. Learning how to sit still with our feelings about loss and failure makes us better able to sit with others through their losses and witness to their suffering. It makes us better partners, better leaders, better parents, and better friends. It makes us more compassionate, more willing to acknowledge when we need a helping hand, and more willing to offer the same to someone who is being treated unfairly or someone who has stumbled and fallen. It makes us braver. So your cell phone, your keys, the paperwork, that's just the beginning. Go ahead. Lose farther and faster. Working with instead of against each other, we can handle just about any disaster.